pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. And for a little change of pace, I'd like to thank myself for that introduction. The Iron Fist, aka Trevor, who is a faithful warrior in the war to restore the Enlightenment, like any soldier, needs some R&R, and he's gone on a family holiday abroad. So, ladies and gentlemen, on this podcast, we have a particular treat for you, a stand-in Iron Fist. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Scott, and I feel deeply honoured to take the Iron Fist's place today, and I hope I can live up to expectations, and I think we'll have a good conversation.
Well, as most of our listeners know, they don't expect too much, therefore they don't get disappointed.
Yeah, that's probably a sound policy.
And because we have someone new joining us tonight, we probably should repeat our usual disclaimer. Paul, both myself and Paul did meet through the Secular Party of Australia, but just that does not mean that this is an official podcast of the Secular Party. It is a couple of blokes having a chat about the news and looking at it through secular tinted glasses.
Yes, yes.
And, tonight, Paul, I'd like to start off with good news.
And what's that, Scott?
The good news is that recently, and I think you were there at the meeting of the Humanist Society when we discussed helping fund an Ipsos poll onto people's religious leanings and how that influenced their vote. Well, mm-hmm. The results are out.
Yeah. And what are the results?
The conversation today, where are we? What date was it? Sorry, the 13th, which is yesterday, September the 13th. Most Australian voters are not influenced by religion.
Yes, it's an interesting result.
Absolutely, and it's a cracking good read, people, so do get on there and have a look. But the survey was conducted on behalf of the Rationalist Association New South Wales and, as I said, the Humanist Society of Queensland. And what it found was that of those people who responded, only 14% said that religion had any influence over their vote.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, 14%.
14%.
It's very underwhelming, isn't it? That's a number.
It's got to make Jim Wallace and others from the Australian Christian Lobby concerned about their future.
Look, I suspect Jim Wallace and co. would probably dispute the number and claim that it was rubbish because it doesn't agree with their view of the world.
I would expect so. But Max Wallace was the gentleman who is the Vice President of the Rationalist Association in New South Wales, and he was the driving force behind this particular survey. Mm-hmm. Wallace did make a couple of points where he cautioned the enthusiasm of people like myself, where he says it does not automatically follow that a majority of Catholics say in various apologies. What he's saying here is that he's talking about the old assumption that there was this Catholic vote.
Yes.
Remember that assumption, Paul, where you had idea that all Catholics were going to vote the same way because they were Catholics?
And I suspect a lot of people doubted that was true for quite a long time now. But we have numbers now.
We've got the numbers. We've got the evidence to say that it's no longer the case. Now, Max Wallace has said it does not automatically follow the majority of Catholics say in various electorates will vote as one for political parties whose policies echo those of the church.
Mm.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Brother, we're saved.
Yep.
But then Wallace goes even further here where he says, I'd suggest the widespread indifference to religion when voting squares with what we know about Australian support for voluntary euthanasia, gay marriage, and their very low regular church attendance.
Yes.
I think that this survey, Paul, it simply is reinforcing what I think a lot of us already knew.
Yeah. Which is that most people vote according to what they think is reasonable and rational. And this word rational is thrown about quite loosely sometimes. But I think most people are essentially rational, regardless of their religious orientation or whatever. And they vote according to what they think is going to be the best outcome.
Agreed. And look, I think there's a couple of takeaway points to take from it, listeners. But my eyesight's getting bad, isn't it? If we break up that 100%, you've got 5% of people said that they were very much, that their vote was very much influenced by their religious belief.
Mm-hmm.
9% said it was somewhat influenced.
Yep.
26% said it wasn't applicable because they didn't have religious views. And 60% said it was not applicable at all. And even better than that, if we drill down into what people said their religious beliefs were, among Catholics, the not influenced at all group was 84%.
Yes.
So my takeaway from that, listeners, is that the Catholic vote, in inverted commas, as it was always talked about, is now in the same category as the Loch Ness Monster. It does not exist.
Yeah. Look, the other interesting item mentioned in that for me was that he said it was certainly possible that that religious factor in their voting patterns might be more significant for conservative Christians, i.e. Pentecostals, evangelicals, fundamentalists, call them what you may, that those people who take their Christianity or indeed even their Islam or their Jewishness more
Judaism,
seriously,
Hinduism, whatever, yes,
may in fact vote more closely along the lines recommended by their local religious authority. But, you know, as we know, those particular groups are still a minority in
Absolutely.
This country.
And look, you know, it begs the question then, why has our federal government bent over backwards for the Australian Christian lobby? You know, if there was Jim Wallace and, what's his name, Lyle Shelton and Wendy what's-her-name, if they were listening, you know, I would suggest that they'd probably be looking for a new job.
Well, they should be.
Well, perhaps I'm a little optimistic, but... Yeah. Look,
they represent a certain constituency, and you know, that's their right, and good luck to them. But if they think that, well, I mean, you know, what the rest of us in the community should be considering is, are their views relevant to the rest of us? In fact, we are the majority. Those of us who think religion is not a greatly influential factor in our voting patterns, we are in fact the majority according to this survey.
Absolutely, we're the majority, and we should be no longer accepting these glib responses from our members and senators when they say, well, this is what the religious groups want.
That's
well,
right.
They are the minority, and I don't think it's unreasonable for us in the majority to say, well, no, we're not going to accept that.
So, and we also perhaps should be cautioning our political leaders not to make too many concessions to the concerns of religious leaders and their demands.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
If this is indeed rule by majority, then the majority is saying religion should not be a factor in our secular lives.
Absolutely. And Wallace does make that point here. If I've got the right quote from the article... most religious people in Australia, as well as most non-believers, accept the government's role as one of providing worldly protections and benefits. For most Australians, other worldly concepts to do with sinning against God, spiritual salvation and the like are private matters. And I would underline that, put it in bold with an exclamation point at the end of it. It is a private matter.
I absolutely agree.
And so that's a... Running on from the good news we had a couple of weeks ago about Andrew Daniels government knocking off the SRI program in Victoria.
Yeah, that
and
was good news.
It was very good news, as was the change to the religious question in the ABS census next year.
Yes.
So I said at the time that we've turned a corner, that there will be good news, and well, there's another bit of good news.
Indeed. Yes. And for those of us who think that people are perfectly entitled to hold religious views in the private domain, it absolutely accords with our views,
absolutely.
I think.
Absolutely, and no one's going to come bashing through a front door saying, give us your Bible, we're going to burn it. That's not going to happen.
No, it isn't going to happen, and nor should it. And, but at the same time, government is supposed to be about managing the country for everyone, and people's private views are private views and should remain private views. Or I don't mean private in terms of being secret, but what I mean is they shouldn't be made to affect the choices and the lifestyles of those who have different conceptions of the real world, if
Precisely
I can put it that
right.
way.
And as they said here, we accept government's role in providing worldly protection otherworldly yes. concepts, blah, blah, blah.
That's right.
So as the other, it's there in black and white now. So it'll be interesting to see how the ACL counters that. They haven't come out yet, but no doubt it's only a matter of time.
It's only a matter of time, yeah.
And it does make some of the more conservative members of our current government look a little bit like they're, frankly, barking up the wrong tree.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next item of news that we've selected, this is from the Melbourne Age. Andrew's government at odds with religious groups over same-sex adoption. Paul, would you like to take the lead on this one?
Look, I think it's about time. I've been waiting for quite a few years now for a politician to have the backbone to stand up and publicly back rational education. And as far as I'm concerned, to deny children the opportunity to understand the world in a comprehensive fashion rather than a narrowly defined, preordained fashion that their elders seem to think is the only thing that could possibly inform their lives, I think it's about time, it's over time, that our politicians stood up and defied pressure from religious groups and said, listen, our children's education is all about understanding the world. It's not about copying your ideas and just following what you think the world is or should be, but it's about giving our children the education to help them understand the world and make their own understandings, to find their own understandings of the world.
And to succeed or fail based on what they have learned, not what they have been told to do. And so, you know, that ending SRI was a great first step. The next step is removing discrimination.
Old prejudices.
Absolutely.
Removing old prejudices.
What a horrible concept, but still and all, the crux of it is that we've got a situation in Victoria where Andrew's government has moved to remove discriminations against same-sex couples in the adoption sphere.
Yes.
Now, Andrew's government, Daniel Andrews is for those outside of Victoria, he has appointed a person, Martin Foley, to the position of Equality Minister.
Uh-huh.
So I suspect this is going to be a longer-term project, shall we call it? I don't know if project demeans it too much, if that might demean it too much, but it is a... It appears to be part of an agenda to remove discrimination in all facets of government.
Yes.
And one of those bits of discrimination that they found is in the adoption law.
Okay.
Now, in the adoption law in Victoria, if you are a homosexual couple and you have, for example, your brother or sister dies and there are no other relatives to take their son or daughter, you can be given custody of that son or daughter, but you are able to adopt that child, but your partner cannot be a co-adoptant. They can't be the adopted parent. With the changes to the laws that are coming through, you will not be discriminated against. It will be looked at, you will be looked upon as what you're capable of providing that child, whether you're providing them a decent home. So issues such as your behaviour and your financial position will be taken into account, not your sexuality.
Okay.
Now,
in other words, you'll be looked upon as human beings capable of providing a good, loving, supportive home environment rather than as people with a particular sexual orientation.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's well, I wouldn't have thought that was too radical, would you?
You wouldn't have think
so. No, you wouldn't think so. Anyway, surprise, surprise. Well, the Australian Christian lobby has got involved. Now, they have lobbied the Daniels government to try and put in the ability for religious organisations to discriminate based on religious beliefs.
Religious exemption.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, a Mr. Dan Flynn, who's the Victorian director of the Australian Christian Lobby, he has had in his submission to the review of the Adoption Act, the ACL has urged the government to follow New South Wales, which granted exemptions when adoption reform passed the lower house 5 years ago. The group has also argued that parents relinquishing their children should have the right to reject gay families on the grounds that it is in the child's best interest to be raised by a mother and a father.
Yeah.
Forgive me, Paul, but if you're relinquishing a child, and you're giving up your parental rights. I would have thought that you'd be more concerned about whether or not the child was going to have a roof over their heads.
Wouldn't you think?
Food on the table, yeah. That sort of stuff, rather than whether or not dad and dad share a bed.
Yeah. And they have a very, I don't know if selective is the right word, but a very skewed idea of what the child's interests are. The child's interests apparently have to accord with their particular religious interests rather than, strictly speaking, what will create a good and nurturing environment for the child to grow in.
Mm.
Yeah.
Which one would have thought would be the more important issue.
Wouldn't you think?
Yeah. But anyway, again, the Equality Minister, Martin Fowler, who's never heard of him before today, but I'm really impressed.
Yes.
Mr. Foley told the Sunday Age, which presumably is the Sunday publication of the Age,
yeah.
He said, "We are approaching this issue on the basis that we are seeking to remove discrimination from the Adoption Act at any level. So I'm not sure how instituting, as New South Wales has done, a lesser form of discrimination yeah. is a good outcome in the yes. interest of the
Surely
child.
Discrimination is discrimination.
It's discrimination is discrimination is discrimination.
That's right.
So if the ultimate goal is to remove discrimination, then why on earth would you then institute a new layer of discrimination simply because someone's waving a magic book?
That's right.
Yeah, so Mr. Flynn clearly... Well, I mean, this was published before the conversation on the most Australian voters are not influenced by religion. But Mr. Flynn quotes that there are 1 million Catholics in Victoria. Yeah. Of that 1 million, I don't know how many are of voting age. But what were our first article told us?
Tells us 84% of them don't care.
And the Catholic vote is the Loch Ness Monster.
Apparently, yes. So Mr. Flynn apparently is barking up the wrong
look place. he's behind the times. It's and look, you know, as a former member of the Liberal Party, I've got to say it always disappoints me when a Liberal opposition or a Liberal government barks up the wrong tree also. Yes. But the opposition leader Matthew Guy has previously declared he supports same-sex adoption but does grant his MPs a conscience vote. Well, he's already ahead of Tony Abbott in that respect.
He is,
yes,
but he's still trying to...
No, he's trying to have two bob each way.
He is, exactly. Yeah.
He said that he would be comfortable with religious exemptions. Look, and this is something that originally attracted me to the secular party and the humanist organisations, Paul, I don't understand why discrimination that is based on a religion is any less discrimination than any other form of discrimination.
No, particularly when the religious concepts that inform that discrimination or that prejudice are based on things that nobody's ever seen. In other words, invisible friends, if I can put it like that.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that's... I don't know. I'm trying to work out what I'm not seeing. You know, I do try and see both sides of the argument,
yes.
but I don't understand why a discriminatory attitude that is informed yeah. by an ancient text is any more relevant than
yeah.
discrimination based on anything else.
Look, it takes me back to something I've thought for a number of years now, and that is that some people seem to think that tradition is inherently a good thing. Okay, and I think a lot of these old religious documents and the ideas that come from them are basically the underpinnings of particular cultural traditions. Now, I sometimes say to friends, well, if tradition is so good, why don't we still have slavery, you know? What? Well, seriously, I mean, slavery was a tradition in a lot of cultures around the world for a very long time. Now, if tradition is in itself inherently a good thing, why have so many traditions gone by the wayside throughout at least the last few hundred years of human history? If they were all so good, why do we still not have them? You know, and this is something I often say to friends, traditions should be preserved if they're worth preserving. And I don't think a lot of these
old... If they're not worth preserving, then you preserve them in a history book.
Exactly.
So that we know we know where we've been
yes.
from. Yeah.
Or I like to call it the Museum of Bad Ideas.
do like that. I'm going to use that. So, so you heard it here first.
Well, there's been a number of them. I mean, they used to bind young girls' feet in China.
Yeah.
Yes. And now that was perhaps allegedly just a sexual fetish for wealthy Chinese men.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Who could afford to accumulate attractive young women. And now there was some idea that they bound their feet so that they couldn't walk very fast, so they couldn't run away. But apparently it was really a sexual fetish that for some reason, I don't know why, they found this tiny little foot on a woman sexually attractive. But there you go. But, you know, as I said, I don't believe in preserving tradition just for its
tradition's
own sake.
Yeah, you know. Agreed. So, you know, another tick to the Daniel Andrews government in Victoria.
Yes, give them a tick.
They have,
big tick.
They do deserve it because that's two now.
Absolutely.
And so, and they also, if I may indulge my optimistic side, I think that Victoria could well be the first domino when it comes to SRI. You know,
okay.
The rest of the country, it will take time, but...
Look, somebody has to take the lead.
Yes.
And if Foley's government... Andrew's government is taking the lead in social advancement. Good for them.
Exactly.
All power to them.
And it just makes the other state premiers look like...
Look backward.
Well, they do look backward.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
We'll file this next one under Catholic wackos.
Okay.
I do promise we won't just exclusively pick on Catholics tonight, Paul.
No, we
but
wouldn't
unfortunately,
do that anyway, would we?
Look, you know... The Church of Rome has provided us with an awful lot of material in this last couple of weeks, haven't they?
Oh, look, they're a font of material.
Absolutely. Really. Well, tonight, to really add to that growing list of pressures that the tiny percentage of people who end up finding that they are not, that the gender they were assigned at birth isn't their real gender. So it's such a tiny portion of the population. So let's...
Infinitesimal.
Absolutely. And so let's just add a little more pressure to them, shall we?
Okay.
But if someone finds that the sex they were assigned with in utero is wrong, the Catholic Church says they can't be a godparent.
No.
So
they're beyond the pale.
The Catholic Church has said that's it. They just can't do it. So this comes from a gentleman now, I apologise, who was born as a woman in Spain and now at the age of 21 wanted to become his nephew's godfather.
Mm.
Now, initially he was knocked back and then the bishop in the area said, well, actually, no, let's wait. Let's go ask the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
And the Vatican then ruled and said, no, the original,
well,
the
they
original
had
decision
a,
was
a
wrong.
New relatively liberal pope after all.
Yeah.
There was some hope for him.
Certainly in terms of the way he treats the poor, he's probably light years ahead of any of his previous ones.
Oh, look, I think, you know, even for someone who's not of a religious disposition like me, I would have to give credit to the Pope for coming out so publicly and defying the old conservative notions that a lot of people in the Vatican have promoted over so many years.
Foisted on us is what I'd
foisted
say.
On us, yes. Dictated to us, I would say.
Well, that's an even better word, yes exactly.
Yeah.
But no, so the Vatican had a presumably some sort of kangaroo court in St. Peter's.
That would be unusual for them, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So a group of celibate men got together to discuss.
And decided,
on
issues of biological... Sure. I don't know. I mean, you know, if you read the science on the topic of gender identity, it's the, you know, what I would call the bleeding obvious is that biology defies our sort of pedestrian concepts of sexuality, doesn't it? I mean, we grow up thinking there are boys and there are girls, but what scientists who are the ones we should be looking at, we should be asking the experts, the people who devote so many years of their professional lives to understanding at a deep level things like this, regardless of what sort of science it is. These people are telling us, sorry, but gender is a little bit ambiguous for some people.
Mm.
And for goodness sake, why not let them be who they feel
they
really
feel
are?
And you know what, Paul? They're going to know a hell of a lot more than a couple of old blokes sitting around a dining room table
wouldn't
having
you
a
think?
Chat.
Yes. Wouldn't you think?
And they're also going to know, if they're going to know more than what we do, then they're going to know a hell of a lot more than a guy, than a couple of dozen people wearing purple robes in Vatican City.
Yes.
So.
Yeah.
But look, you know, one of the things that has amused me about the issues around transgender has been the way, let's face it, the American right, particularly the Tea Party, the Republican Party, mm-hmm. have really torn themselves apart on this. Yeah. I mean, it's laughable when they get there and say, well, we've got to have these rules saying that if you're transgender, you've got to use the bathroom that you were, proper term is toilet. So you've got to use the toilet that for which you were originally signed at birth and all that sort of stuff. I mean, this is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's a non-issue. And for some reason...
It is for most people,
yes,
I would think.
And people are tearing themselves apart.
Yeah.
And I don't understand it. And
look, I think in America, you know, there's the added factor that Americans have been raised on a very solid diet of fear of violence. And you know, not without good reason. They do tend to have... some fairly extreme incidents of public violence,
yeah.
which, you know, we can't discount. But, I mean, they are, you know, through their media, their entertainment industry, for goodness sake, give them a very constant, solid diet of violence. So it's no wonder that Americans are scared, is it, really? and it's just one more thing to be scared of.
Yeah, which, and look, I'm the first to admit if I don't understand something, my first reaction is probably fear.
It's a human reaction.
Yeah.
It really is.
But when you do educate yourself, I mean, even if you don't understand it, you're going to have a better understanding.
Yeah.
And while I'm very fortunate to have always felt male, I can imagine that if I had felt female, that it would be a very heavy burden to deal with, and then to have nonsense like this coming from Rome is only going to make life harder.
Look, what could be possibly the problem? If a female person decides she's a male and she goes into the men's toilet,
what's the big deal?
What are they scared of?
Exactly.
If it was a male person who grew up and decided that he was a female, for goodness sake, they've got individual cubicles.
Exactly.
Where's the problem? Where's the issue?
But also, you know, the other thing too is that the whole individual cubicle thing, that's not universal either. In lots of Asia, you just have unisex toilets. Anyway, but that's by the by. It was a very interesting little thing just that we thought was bringing up.
It does show just how, I don't know, paranoid that the Catholic Church is about anything related to sexuality, Scott.
Absolutely. And gender issues generally. I mean, like, the old men of the church are scared of women. I don't know why.
I think that is. And I think that's a historical fear of women, because women have this incredible power of reproduction that men don't have. Mm. I mean, let's face it, men make a contribution. But their contribution is...
relatively small.
Quantitatively rather minute. And let's face it, women have this incredible power that men don't have. And men, I think, in more traditional societies probably fear that power. And they, you know, their response is to try to control that.
Yes.
So there you go.
And I don't think that's exclusive to the Christian religion.
No, not at all.
It
in fact,
seems to be across... all of the religions.
Across all of them, yeah.
It's a very patriarchal thing, if that's the right word.
I think it is.
Yeah.
Yes. It's patriarchal and it's tribal. And, you know, I think it's a holdover from our primitive past, frankly.
Well, probably.
Yeah.
One day when someone's got time and the budget to do it, they'll be able to look back on an evolutionary sort of thing and go into it and see where it all really comes from.
Look, there has been a lot of work done on the evolution of our societies and our customs and habits. And I think the problem is that a lot of that stuff just isn't sexy enough to be in the popular media. You know, people are more interested in the clothes that some celebrities wear,
Kim Kardashian's backside.
Than they are in, you know, why we do anything that we actually do in our normal daily lives, you know?
Yeah.
In terms of our social structure and our basic social customs, you know? Which is a great pity, to my way of thinking.
Oh, but I don't think that includes the listeners of this podcast, I reckon.
Surely not.
They're out reading as much as...
No, they're of a different calibre, I'm sure.
I'm sure of that. But moving on from the beginning of life to the end of life.
Indeed.
So, again, from the conversation, and listeners, believe it or not, if you make a financial contribution to the conversation, it's tax deductible. So if you're one of these people that absolutely...
So don't hold back.
Go for it. Throw money at it. I mean, it's a fine dining three-course meal when it comes to journalism as opposed to a Big Mac and fries. But we've got a piece here, again, also from Russell Blackford, who was the same gentleman that wrote the first article we were talking about, and he's discussing voluntary euthanasia. Mm. In the title of his article is Voluntary Euthanasia, Beware the Godly.
Yeah.
Now, the United Kingdom...
If we may mention, he is a lecturer in philosophy at the University of Newcastle. So surely he's devoted quite a lot of his own time
to thinking deeply
through this issue, and not only thinking, but obviously reading widely and considering all the various points of view.
He's got a quite lengthy article there, so we'll try and pick the eyes out of it. But there is a move in the United Kingdom from a Labour MP in the House of Commons, Rob Maris, who has put forward a private members bill for physician-assisted suicide, or as we would call it, voluntary euthanasia.
That's right. Look, physician-assisted, I think, is a very key term, because it's not just a matter of, you know, people, you know...
Hooking up the garden hose
chopping
to the
themselves,
car.
Yes. It can be done in a very civilised and orderly manner.
Exactly. And it's a calm... You know, one of the things that I find about this, the hysteria around voluntary euthanasia, Paul, I hate to break it to you, at some stage you're going to die.
No.
Yes.
No.
It's going to happen.
Oh, right? Scott, did you have to break it to me while we're recording?
Yeah, yeah. I know. But all of us, it's the only thing we've all got in common. We are all going to die one of these days.
Oh, okay.
And when that does happen, frankly, I have seen loved relatives of mine die, in inverted commas, naturally. And then I also had I know a human being is not the same as a dog, but just bear with me here while I go through this analogy.
Okay.
I had a loved dog that I had taken from a 12-week-old pup right through until he was 12.
Yeah.
And I had to take him to the vet for the last time a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a few months after seeing a relative of mine die naturally.
Mm.
Now, the Right to Die Queensland people, they have a bumper sticker that says, I deserve to die like a dog. And frankly, after seeing the difference between dying naturally and dying with physician-assisted death,
yeah,
we all deserve to die like dogs. Yeah. Now, this is an issue that Europe has dealt with. I think the Dutch were the first, or was it the Swiss?
I'm not sure.
Not sure, but one of those two European countries did go first with allowing their citizens to...
Yes.
Choose the timing of their death under certain circumstances. Mm. So you can't just wake up on a Saturday morning and think to yourself, well, I really don't want to go to work on Monday. Mm. There are certain conditions.
I'll kill myself.
Exactly. There are certain conditions around there that says if you have a terminal illness, if your doctors are certain that the terminal illness is actually terminal and that there really is no hope for you, and that the pain becomes too much, then with the doctor's assistance, you can choose the timing of your exit.
Mm.
Now, there's, I don't know what the drugs that are used are, but all the rest of it, but they are clearly a lot nicer than gasping for breath.
Yeah.
And so...
I do know what the drugs used are. I don't know if it's worth mentioning on here, but...
Nebutal's one of the more favourites.
That's the one, Nebutal.
But look, Britain has now decided to... Well, I don't know if the British government has decided to deal with this, but certainly a member of the House of Commons has decided to deal with it. Now, yes, you would expect that with a... Let's face it, it's a controversial issue. It's going to arouse both passionate support and passionate opposition.
Mm-hmm.
Where the ears pricked up here at the Iron Fist Velvet Glove headquarters was when the Archbishop of Canterbury got involved.
Yes, as he would.
Well, yeah.
I mean, he is a religious leader, so he probably feels that he's obliged to have a position and to make it public. So, I mean, that's fair enough as far as it goes.
Well, We live in a liberal democracy.
Absolutely.
And the grandmother of liberal democracies was the United Kingdom.
Yes.
So.
And he's entitled to have a position.
He's entitled to have a position. Whether or not he's entitled to get that position legislated is another story.
Well, that's the crux of the issue, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
I mean, he's entitled to have a position. Is he entitled to exert undue or, if you like, disproportionate influence on the political process and have his view legislated?
And, well, listeners, just to let you in on a little secret, around this table, there's no argument. No, he doesn't. However, let's go through where Professor, well, I don't know if he's a professor, but we'll call him Professor Blackford, demolishes the argument one by one.
Mm.
So the argument against it is broken down into four basic positions. One, it's crossing the Rubicon, which I mean, gather that means you've crossed a certain line that we've never crossed before. So crossing the Rubicon, Professor Blackford argues that a carefully regulated process, allowing a place for assisted suicide does not require or even somewhat insinuate that we should no longer respect lives of others.
Hmm.
It does not. That is, require or insinuate that we should no longer see the lives of others as demanding our consideration.
Yeah. That's an extraordinary position to take, isn't it? He's basically saying that if you agree with physician-assisted suicide, then you no longer have respect for human right. For human life.
Of course, that's the Archbishop of Canterbury's position.
Yeah.
But I find that peculiar. I would have thought that amongst adults, that we all understand that the only thing between us and the ovens or the grave is time, that we, not being childlike, should be able to, if we find it insufferable, to be able to say to the doctor, can I have some Nebutol?
Yes.
And that's then going to trigger a whole range of meetings and discussions and so on and so forth. So I found it peculiar that the Archbishop puts up this argument that it's not respecting life to allow someone to decide how their life comes to an end.
You could even suggest that he's in fact doing the opposite. He's taking away people's personal agency.
Absolutely.
To decide that they don't feel the quality of their life is sufficient any longer to prolong it.
Mm.
And in fact, they would rather that they died with control over their own destiny.
You know, at home.
At home.
With some friends
with
or family.
People that they care for.
Yeah.
But no, he's saying they don't have that right.
Yeah.
Because he knows better than they do.
Absolutely.
He's infantilizing these people by saying, sorry, they're not capable of deciding the quality of their, what quality their life should be or how long it should persist.
Yeah. And he's able to put that point of view because he understands a magic book.
Yes, indeed.
So, you know, I mean, that first crossing the Rubicon, okay, you know, let's go back to your original point about slavery. There was a time when someone said we shouldn't keep slaves.
Yes.
Did we stop that person because it was crossing a Rubicon?
Some people probably used
tried.
The same argument.
They
at
probably
the time,
did try.
You know,
the whole evolution of our society, not even the physical, biological evolution of our species, but of our laws and everything else, has come from people crossing a Rubicon at some stage. So I don't take that argument with any sort of
sense. It's an old cliche, which, like a lot of old cliches, should be put out to pasture.
Absolutely. But look, you know, but Blackford gives it more time than what I do in that he goes into a methodical sort of destruction of the argument.
Yes.
And the particular point that I found very interesting was he goes to the point to say, if you have physician-assisted suicide, you're not going to get rid of them. Criminal act of murder or manslaughter, there will still be state powers there to protect you from violence.
That's right.
So this is just a...
So he does concede that we cannot, and it's probably impossible, to eliminate all acts of foul play. And there may well be people who, you know, want to sort of help their old people along a bit, you know,
so they
for
can
whatever
inherit
reason.
The front,
yes,
the,
for
the
whatever
waterfront
reason.
Place, yeah.
But I mean, that sort of criminal activity takes place anyway.
Exactly.
Let's face it.
Yeah. So it's just not. It's not pretty, but it happens.
It happens. And it's not an argument for denying those people who are in control of their own lives and their own destiny. It's not a, not an argument for denying them the right to choose, is it?
Agreed. Next argument on the Archbishop's list was protecting vulnerable people. He claims that a law permitting assisted suicide would place a very large number of vulnerable people in danger. From what that he comes down to, he's basically arguing that mum and dad have got a beachfront place. The kids are saying, well, mum, you know, you're not well, you know, you really don't have quality of life.
That's
so let's finish it. You know what?
Because it's a nice property and, you know, you're just sort of, you know, making a nuisance of yourself by hanging around.
Well, you'd think that the kids would probably be smart enough not to say that to mum, but, you know, there are some pretty dumb people out there. So that's the Archbishop's argument. And
but the law, that as it stands now, surely already protects those people, doesn't it? It already criminalises behaviour that would quite deliberately help the old people on their way.
Well, I would have thought so.
Wouldn't you think?
And you'd think you'd also think so with a regime of physician-assisted suicide that
that there would be safeguards built into the the legislation.
Exactly. So, you know, Paul, you're 97 and you've got terminal something or other, and I'm your physician, and right before we can make this final decision, I want you to have a lengthy discussion with a psychologist. And that psychologist, they're not stupid people, ladies and gentlemen, they're not.
In fact, they're usually well-educated.
Absolutely.
And very reasonable people.
And they're going to pick up fairly quickly if you've got grasping children trying to get your waterfront place.
That's right. And they would also be able to make a judgment on whether or not you are sufficiently in control of your own faculties to make that sort of judgment.
But look, it is, you know, there has been reports of some people that have taken advantage of the physician-assisted suicide laws on the continent. And there has been some of the things that do weigh on parents. Now, I'm not a parent, but I can imagine this would be something that you'd be concerned about, where a number of people have actually cited that they didn't want to be a burden on their children.
Yeah.
I think, and Blackford goes to say, yes, that's an entirely natural thing for someone to say. But let's face it, we've got to give a bit of credit to our doctors and our psychiatrists who are going to be dealing with these cases to be able to let them judge for themselves whether or not that's just a natural reaction or whether it's as a result of pressure from kids.
Surely.
So, again, Blackford goes into a lot more detail than what I do, but he has got a very strong argument there as to why this is something that's, it's a roadblock, but it's not something that can't be overcome.
Look, these, you know, professional, whether they be doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, whatever, I mean, they're not infallible. None of us are. They're only human. But surely they're probably better equipped to make a reasonable assessment of a person's eligibility, of their condition, of whatever other factors are weighing on decisions. They're in a better position to decide, surely, than a local minister of religion.
One would have thought so.
Who've devoted their lives to interpreting these old books that have come down to us from people who basically didn't know where the sun went at night.
Exactly. Yes. So, anyway, and the final argument the Archbishop puts up, you know, always the argument against any reform or change, the slippery slope.
Yeah.
Do you want to attack the slippery slope or...?
The slippery slope. Look, it brings to mind the old eugenics episode in the early 20th century, you know, and people, I mean, it probably started with some sort of, you know, lofty ideals of creating a better society. But of course, you know, it was a flawed concept, the idea that we could deliberately and methodically create a better human society by limiting reproductive rights to certain
criminals,
people.
Criminals, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But of course, you know, I mean, we came through that relatively unscathed. Well, not completely,
well,
but
not
relatively
completely,
unscathed.
Yeah.
And we've come out the other end, and we do have a lot of respect for life, I think, in a society such as ours. And we take, you know, it's not a perfect society, but now we're starting to move more and more towards making life not only more comfortable, but providing more opportunities to people who aren't, I'm not sure what the politically correct term is, but people who aren't 100% physically able to do all the things that most of us take for granted. So I think we have become a more kind and humane society.
Absolutely.
Overall.
We're a species that's capable of caring, and I think that it shows the ultimate care in that if people can allow someone who is terminally ill and in a lot of pain to choose the time,
yes,
and the method in which they will go, mm-hmm, I think that's the ultimate show of compassion.
Yes,
myself.
Indeed.
But look, I think Blackford even puts it better, if I may say, where he talks about the slippery slope argument. He said, if we legalize assisted suicide, so it suggests, we will become a society in which no longer shows love, care and compassion to those who at all ages and stages of life are contemplating suicide, and we no longer view each life as worthy of protecting.
Yeah.
Now, in a society like the United Kingdom, like Australia, physician-assisted suicide is going to be a big quantum leap for people. So to suggest that doctors that have spent their working lives trying to preserve life are then going to suddenly flippantly say, bring on a morphine overdose, nonsense.
No.
They're going to very, very carefully consider it before, and they're going to be very careful in selecting those patients that are, that's the wrong word, but acquiescing to patients' wishes.
Yes.
If they feel they've got someone there that doesn't fit the bill, they're not going to allow it to happen.
No.
You know, so I think we have to have a fair amount. I think we've got to place a bit of trust in our professionals.
I think so. I think we can assume most doctors are not only very decent people and well-trained in what they do, but for goodness sake, they professionally can't afford to be seen as people who don't respect the lives of the people in their care, and certainly their insurance premiums would shoot up dramatically if they were seen as being irresponsible with the lives of their patients.
Dr. Smith at the RPA, who deals with palliative care, is not Dr. Josef Mengele.
No.
You know,
no.
Very different things. But the final word goes, of course, because, you know, we all look at everything through secular coloured glasses here, but I love this line that Blackford's put in there. Religious leaders such as the Archbishop have no particular authority, intellectual, moral or otherwise, in respect of issues that relate to decisions at the beginning and end of life.
That's right.
You know, that he makes it very strong. He makes the point very strongly there that they're not doctors.
No. And they seem to operate on the assumption that because they study these old books, that they have some sort of authority over the rest of us.
Or a knowledge that the rest of us couldn't possibly understand.
Yes, yes. Yeah. It's a kind of black art, really.
Mm, absolutely. In the last week or so, Australia has stepped up to say that Australia is increasing its intake of refugees. We
Indeed.
Won't get too bogged down on whether or not it's right or whether the numbers are okay, mm-hmm, but we are. Instead of having completely closed borders, we have said that as an international citizen, we will increase our refugee intake of 12,000 for Syrians. Now, mm-hmm, of course, you know, never let it go for people like George Christensen. Never let an opportunity go by. And we've had people arguing that Christians should be at the front of the queue.
Yeah.
Look,
which does seem discriminatory.
Absolutely.
On the face of it.
Yeah. And look, while I don't think it was right for our government to say, let's get the Christians out, I do think that the UNHCR is probably going to be taking the view, let's see which people will be able to rebuild a life once the civil war is over.
Yeah.
If that's the case, from what we've seen of other strong Arab dictators that have fallen, it is the religious minorities that do seem to have a hard time of it.
Indeed.
So that being the case, one would assume that the UNHCR is probably going to put Christians at the front of the queue anyway, in which case it was just posturing on our part. Paul, what are your thoughts?
Oh, look, my thoughts are, and you know, I'm not of a religious bent, as you know, so I don't have any particular affection for any particular religion over another one, but I think a case probably can be made, and I'm open to persuasion on this one. I think a case could be made that in an area of the world where there is a fairly bloodthirsty and violent and ruthless outlaw regime that is actively persecuting religious minorities, you could make a case that the ones that are furthest away from what they see as the right and proper and ideal religion, i.e. Islam, would certainly be suffering more than perhaps the others. I don't know. But I think a case could be made that you take those who are, as you said it, least likely to be able to resettle in those countries, take them as being perhaps more persecuted. I don't know if you can measure persecution, but look, I have great sympathy for anyone, regardless of their ethnicity or their religious orientation. If they're suffering, they're all human beings, and I wouldn't like to discriminate on the basis of religion, but I think a case might be made, and I say might be made, to give priority to Christians, especially to Christians perhaps coming to a country where they will, if you like, integrate more easily into what was predominantly a Christian society like Australia's. I mean, like you, Scott, I'm a little perplexed that the wealthy Arab countries, particularly the Gulf states, seem to be taking a very hard line against accepting anybody at all. Some of them have contributed money. I think the figure is something like £900 million or thereabouts that they've contributed.
900 million euros to, was the number I'd read. Yeah,
to relief for Syrian and other refugees. But they seem very reluctant, Scott, to actually take them into their own homes, as so many people in certain parts of Europe have, particularly the Germans, to their great credit, have shown great kindness to these people. Where is the kindness coming from the people who claim to be the followers of the one true religion, the religion of mercy and kindness and peace and all the other adjectives that you may attach to it or they may attach to it? Where is the evidence on the ground that they are extending that sort of human kindness to their own brothers in religion, after all, brothers and sisters in religion?
And look, Paul, you're right, and I must admit, listeners, I apologise, I hadn't printed out the article. It wasn't just from The Onion or BuzzFeed or something like that. It was from a reputable source.
Yeah.
I think it was an article in The Independent, but it was... The Hajj is coming up. I believe it's this month. Yes. Or is it October?
I'm not sure if it's actually on now, Scott, but there are people there.
Yeah.
And this incident with the crane collapsing
on the mosque
in Mecca seems to be a bit of a spanner in the works for those people, but they're going on with it anyway.
For those who don't know, the Hajj is a pilgrimage that all members of the faithful have to make at one stage in their life.
Mm.
Now, it is basically running around Muhammad's tomb.
There are a number of rituals that they participate in. One is walking around the big...
great big black marble box in the centre of stadium.
Yeah, it's actually the black marble is just in one corner of the structure, actually. Right. And some people speculate that it was probably originally a meteorite that fell to earth, and some desert nomad picked it up and thought,
this must be God.
This is a bit special.
Yeah.
I'll hang on to this. Yeah. And eventually it found its way into the foundations of this building. And that's a kind of an interesting story in itself. But yeah, they engage in a number of rituals. One is walking around that building, and the name of it escapes me. I'm not sure why. But there are others. You know, there are other various rituals that they undertake in the Mecca area.
The point that I wanted to make out of this article anyway was that Saudi Arabia has accommodation for approximately 3.5 million people. In tents.
Very nice tents.
These aren't just ordinary tents. No. You know, these aren't the tents
you and I would give. Tents.
These are air-conditioned tents. Yes. They have water and sanitation and everything.
Australian caravan parks would be green with envy.
Green with envy, absolutely. These are really swank camping sites.
They certainly are.
Now, they can accommodate 3.5 million people.
That's a lot of campers.
That's an awful lot of campers. There are currently 4 million Syrians living outside of Syria because it's not safe to stay in a place where explosives are falling from the sky. And
people are shooting at each other.
Exactly. So I would have thought that considering the Federal Republic of Germany says they're going to be taking 800,000 this year, I would have thought that perhaps the religious authorities in Saudi Arabia could say, considering the crisis that has befallen our brethren Muslims, we're going to postpone the Hajj so that this accommodation can be made available to those unfortunate refugees from the Syrian conflict.
Yeah.
That hasn't happened.
No.
And we'll move, this is a little segue into an article that's come from The Independent. And
just on that subject, Scott, do you suspect that's because the priorities of the religious authorities in Saudi Arabia is not on the needs of people in this life? In other words, those Syrian refugees, those people fleeing violence and persecution in Syria or Iraq or wherever, it seems to me that their real world needs on this earth are considered less important than the next world needs of the people who are doing the Hajj, you know. So their priority is the religious necessities, the religious obligations take precedence over people's real world survival and comfort.
Well,
am I being a bit too cynical, do you think?
I don't know whether or not you're being cynical, because it is a thought that has crossed my mind.
Okay.
I've always been suspicious of anyone who thinks that the next life is obviously better than the current life that we've got. I mean, we know we've got a life because we're living it.
We are.
Whether or not there's
we
one...
We have evidence for this one.
Whether or not there's one beyond the crematorium, I don't know. But to say to people who are having explosives fall on them from the sky, and now we've got the Australians are going to be dropping explosives on them and that sort of stuff, that frankly, your needs are secondary to pilgrims from across the world completing the Hajj, I find that somewhat... is offensive too strong a word?
Look, it gives lie to the common notion that, you know, the Europeans or the Western world in particular are, you know, less morally correct than the people of the one true faith. Because, you know, we all saw the photograph on the news or on the internet or wherever of those poor children who drowned and washed up on a beach. And, you know, it certainly seemed to have had a huge impact in the West, particularly in Germany, because it suddenly provoked them into an outpouring of humanity and kindness. It doesn't seem to have had the same impact or the same effect on the religious authorities in Mecca.
And, you know, let's face it, the Saudis... You know, they're an interesting government, aren't they?
Interesting is one word you might use.
But
I've met and, you know, a number of Saudi people in my daily life, and I find them to be just as human and
absolutely
ordinary as people from any other part of the world. So, you know, we don't want this to be interpreted as a criticism of Saudi people in any way, shape or form.
The Saudi royal family, I think, are separate from the Saudi people.
Yes, and the Saudi, as royal families generally are
but
everywhere.
I think the Saudi royal family has shown themselves to be wanting, to be brutally honest.
Yeah, well, it's you know, not just the Saudi royal family, but the institutions they've created to control and rule over the people of Saudi Arabia that are found wanting, in my opinion.
Mm. But given that this is a crisis for humanity, but it's also a crisis that is largely centred on people who are of that particular faith,
yes.
I would have thought that the religious authorities in Saudi Arabia would say, well, there's probably a better use for those air-conditioned tents.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, on that, you know, Germany's said they'll probably take 800,000 this year. The Saudis, the Saudi government, whose generosity knows no bound, has offered to Germany to build them 200 new mosques.
Yes.
Now, Paul, 200 Moss or food and medicine? What do you reckon is more important?
Well, it's obvious, isn't it, Scott? 200 mosques is more important than Saudis. It's pretty clear. Yes. So the religious education of those refugees, obviously, if they go to Europe, you know, that godforsaken place where, you know, society is so corrupt and degenerate, they obviously need more mosques to keep them on the right path, don't they?
Incredible.
More than they need housing, food, clothing, education, whatever.
Well, sticking with the rules that Trevor set down when we first started this, we are going to try and keep that to the 1 hour mark. And,
okay.
Thank you, we're Scott. Now the 50, we're almost, well, we're now on the hour mark, but Paul, thank you very much on your inaugural broadcast.
It's been a great pleasure, Scott. I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much for inviting me.
No problem at all. Well, listeners, thank you for tuning in, and we'll talk to you again next week. All the best.
See ya.
See ya. Bye now.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends, let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.